Call to order the House Committee on Education for the 20th of May, 2015. Okay, we have three public hearings and two work sessions today, and the first thing we're going to start out with is Senate Bill 820A. Richard, if you want to give us a summary.
Happily. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 820A allows public charter schools to implement a weighted lottery for historically underserved students. The measure also defines historically underserved students. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, so we have Karen Heikes and start with Senator Roblin. Welcome back.
Representative Doherty, if you want to be, come on over anytime. Representative Doherty and Education Committee here in the House. I'm really pleased to be able to come here and explain something that's been important to me. When we first passed the bills to allow for public charter schools in Oregon, one of the things were that they were supposed to be incubators and places for us to figure out and find new ways to doing things to better serve all of Oregon's children.
And Senator, we know you, but the parent, but,
oh, that's
but
right.
not,
and,
but our listening
and
audience.
As
does
such,
not.
I was a high school principal, so you know who I am. This is Senator Arne Roblin from District 5.
Thank you.
Originally from Coos Bay, Oregon, still there actually, but, and a principal. In our school district, we actually worked on a couple different charter schools that I was worked on at the high school to give us an opportunity to use them in ways to find out could we do things better for different groups of students. This bill basically allows for charters who have made a determination that part of the reason they exist, their mission, is to develop programs that work really well for those kids who have been unsuccessful sometimes in schools, those underrepresented students. It's been before the legislature the last number of years, and we have continued to have a problem with respect to the Constitution and how we go about doing that. So when we had this bill, the first conversation I had is it needs to be constitutional. So you need to sit down with our staff in legislative council and figure out how best to do that, because anytime you give an advantage to one group or another, there is an issue. And so the federal government has given some guidelines, and we basically built into this law the guidelines that have been expressed by the federal government and how to go about making sure that the mission of the program can comply with the Constitution and give underserved students the opportunity, a little bit greater opportunity, by having a weighted lottery to keep the proportion there. The problem that we've had at times is when certain charter schools become very successful for whatever reason, the people who know how to use the system and get themselves in place to be in the lottery are not necessarily those that come from poverty, those that come from these disadvantaged groups. So this is an attempt to keep that balance so that the school can meet its own personal mission, and that we can find out are there programs that really work for kids. And so I encourage your support of this bill.
Okay, thank you. Karen?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Karen Heikes with Kairos PDX and about a dozen other good charter schools in this state. Senator Roblin explained the bill well. He is one of the chief sponsors. It's also sponsored by Representative Comp, Senator Haas, Senator Cruz, and Representative Huffman. The way that admission to public charter schools works right now, it's pure lottery. The statute says that enrollment may not be limited based on race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, ethnicity, national origin, disability, or the terms of an IEP, income level, proficiency in English, or athletic ability. And it says if the number of applications from students who reside in the school district exceeds the capacity of a program, class, grade level, or school building, the public charter school shall select students through an equitable lottery selection process. So age and grade are really the only criteria that charter schools can currently use to admit students. What Senate Bill 820 would do is allow charter schools to give some weight to some of these historically underserved students that Senator Roblin identified. And we did work a lot with legislative counsel, looking at the U.S. Constitution, the Oregon Constitution, got some federal guidance on how we do that in the best way and in the most legal way. And because we started out wanting to give priority admission to historically underserved kids, and we realized that we could not actually do that, we needed to use a weighted lottery. So that what that really means is that certain students, the students defined, you know, within this bill, would be able to put their name in the hat more than one time, two times, three times, whatever a charter school policy would dictate. And if a charter school chooses to use this, it would be considered part of the equitable lottery system that statute requires. So it would basically increase the odds of historically underserved students getting into charter schools, which is important when you think about, as Senator Roblin said, how the dominant culture knows how to work the system. And even though it's a lottery, if you have exponential numbers of a certain group in the hat, of course, you know, you're going to have more of those students getting admitted. So Kairos PDX, in particular, we actually requested this bill last session and this session because we designed our school specifically for kids of color and low-income kids, and that's who we have this year. This is our first year. We have kindergarten and first grade, and my colleague who's coming next will talk more about our school. But the way we got those kids was very strategic and kind of under the radar. We didn't put anything online. We tried to be very within the law, of course, but very strategic in our outreach to community-based organizations to make sure that we got the kids we wanted. Now that the school is open and the word is out, we're attracting all sorts of folks who may or may not be our target demographic. So we want to be able to continue to serve the kids we built the school for. So for us, it's particularly important, but I know there are many other charter schools that also love this bill and would love to have more diverse demographics, and this bill would allow them to do that. A lot of other states do this already for charter school admission. I think that's all I have. So if you have questions for us, great. If not, I would love to invite my colleagues from Kairos.
Next, any questions? Representative Bretto.
Thank you. Senator Roblin, when I first heard this yesterday, I just thought it just seemed like manipulating the lottery system. And so the question I have is if you say there are some right now that can work the system in the school, in the charter schools, why wouldn't we be working at preventing that rather than adding another source of manipulation, I guess?
I think that what she's talking about with respect to the organization opportunity, what we do and what we try to do in those places is you go out and you try to recruit. You go out and talk to communities. You do other kinds of things. People will always do that. But there are times when your fame or fortune or whatever you want to say creates this new area where all these other people want to be there, and that numbers outstrip it. What she's saying is there are some states where they have allowed this weighted lottery in other places. It's the first time we've actually had the conversation here to try to keep that balance of the kinds of students who the program was built for. And for me, it's trying to figure out how do we get, if we're developing charter schools to help give us answers as to how best to work with different groups. And one of the big conversations we're having right now is how do we get teachers trained in cultures and other things so that when they're working with kids, they can express and explain something in a way that they'll understand it better than they would if we used the dominant group of people's language with it. We have that problem with lots of different subgroups in our communities. And, you know, I was talking to a friend yesterday who said, yeah, I was working overseas, and all of a sudden I thought, this is going to be great. There's this Australian coming to work with me, and we both speak English. And as soon as he started opening his mouth, he said, I don't know what English they're speaking. They talk too fast, and I couldn't catch on what they were saying. Each culture has their own language and words and other kinds of things. And if you can't express to other people when you're trying to learn them, they have nothing to attach their language to and their previous knowledge, that's how schools work. And I just want to make sure that we continue to have opportunities for teachers and others to learn best practices that can help us make every kid successful in our schools. And I think this is one way that does that.
Follow up.
Thank you. Follow up on that. So if the mission of the school is to serve the underserved, you know, and that's your goal and that's what you're trying to attract, well, then don't you get into a a situation where one who's more underserved than the other one then starts putting in more applications. Isn't it just kind of following that trend?
They're going to have to figure out the individual policy with regard to their charter school with respect to how they weight this, and that'll have to be a part of the open information that people know. But, anytime you have a lottery that does those kinds of things, you have to watch that. And I think that's going to be something that's going to be important for the charter school itself to come to grips with and figure out how they're going to do that.
Yeah, one more follow. I'm not opposed to right. the idea, you know, of getting the underserved in. You know, I'm just looking at the method here. It doesn't seem to. It just doesn't sound right. Okay. So.
Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Springer. Then we'll go down the road.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I look at page 2 of the bill, and you define underserved. Historically underserved students are at risk because of any combination of their race, ethnicity, English language proficiency, socioeconomic status, gender, sexual orientation, disability, and geographic location. So when I saw that, there were a couple, three of those that I could say, well, if I don't fit into the others, I can claim these. And that is, do you have concerns about that definition being so broad that you've maybe not achieved the goal that you're attempting to achieve? This seems to be resonating with you, Senator.
And then I'll turn that over to Karen. Originally, the bill said this smaller group of people. Our legislative council said, no, won't meet the test constitutionally. And the federal government had given us a definition. What you're reading is that definition of what they believe will meet the needs of the Constitution, both Oregon and federal, in my understanding. And that's why that's the definition that's there. That's the one that we got our best information from the federal government so that we didn't get ourselves in trouble. That's the definition they gave.
Follow-up? Well, it's a good reason to use it. Will it get you where you want to go is my concern. Is it going to get you where you want to go?
Chair Doty, Rep. Springer, I believe it will get us where we want to go. We did have many conversations about how to define this, and it could either be not defined at all, which was a risk, or it could be defined too narrowly, which was a risk. And so really the only way to do it was to have it very broadly defined with historically underserved groups. These are all of the historically underserved groups for the most part. So that's why it includes all and not just one or two. We started with definition that the OEIB had last session, but that language said students who had been failed by the systems or systems had failed. There were some folks that objected to that because they didn't like the fact that we were saying the system had failed anybody. We've been through a lot of different iterations and lots of conversations about how can we accomplish our goal, stay within the law, not offend anybody egregiously. Yes, I do think it will help us accomplish our goal.
One last follow-up. Thank you. I don't know what your rulemaking process will be, if there's going to be further rulemaking through ODE, or if it will be your school doing that. And I don't expect a comprehensive answer here, but that looks to me like it could be problematic to get you where you want to go. If you have more males in the school than historically in that school, your females are underserved, or vice versa. That's just an area of concern that I have in the implementation of that.
I understand what you're saying. And we don't anticipate a charter school having a policy that would give weighted lottery for all of the students in this definition.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Probably one or two.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. A question I have for you about the lottery and what the lottery actually looks like. How does that go? I have no idea.
Yeah. You can talk about yours. Yeah. At the school we had, the lottery looked like a bunch of names in a jar, and you pull out the one, and you write the name down, and that's the first person, and you pull out a name in the next one, and that's the second person. Because we had lotteries for the two charters around my campus, and it was just like any other lottery. Everybody that came and was They first come, first serve. They're in the school. All of a sudden, there's more kids than there are seats. So you start pulling out and making a list in order of who's going to get the next seat, who's going to get the next seat. And then if a person leaves or something else happened, you call the first person on the list. So that was the lottery mm-hmm. that we used.
Chair Doherty, Rep. Wilson, that's a great question. And the law is not really specific or the rules about this. And so I've seen a variety of practices amongst charters in Oregon. The vast majority do exactly what Senator Roblin described, whether it's a basket or a bowl or a jar. And sometimes that lottery is done in a public board meeting where there may or may not be members of the public there, but it's in a public meeting and the minutes are taken. Sometimes folks will have a big kind of party celebration. It depends on how oversubscribed the school is. Most charter schools do have wait lists. Most charter schools in our state do have a higher demand than they have room for. So most folks are doing lotteries every year. I have heard of a few doing a computerized, randomized lottery if they have a really, you know, a lot of kids over the number they have spots for, but it's just like it sounds.
Right,
lottery.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative McLean.
I really understand the goal, the intent. I like the idea of trying to make sure that we're assisting and making sure that our resources and the student body are going to match. I think that's all perfect. But it is a public charter school, and so I really, really want to pay attention to the weighted lottery pluses and minuses. And as I've been here in the building for just 9 or 10 weeks, the lottery that we have on a weighted students that we give more funding to, you know, we have ELL weights, and we have, you know, the poverty issue weights and all of those types of things, and those are constantly being discussed because of resources to go toward them. And so I was wondering if the bill or anything about the bill says that this is just a general lottery on just simply population, or if it could be applied to other, you know, other issues, or it could be applied to, or it's going to be revisited at a certain time.
So my answer to that would be this is strictly about being able to get into the program. It has nothing to do with how the money is spent or any of those other kinds of stuff. It is a single lottery. It has to do with who gets to be selected to be on that list. And so it won't be those others like we've had with our formulas and all those other kinds of stuff. It won't have any effect on those.
Okay.
And that's really the only place that we have an option to have a lottery from the law that we wrote about public charter schools and even the federal government stuff with respect to lottery.
Okay, thank you. Representative Reardon.
Well, it's really interesting. Historically underserved defines most of the students in one of the districts that I serve. So
that's right.
You've got a good target audience there, I guess. But on the lottery now, does that apply, is that used for all the students that would enter the school or some percentage of the students that would enter the school?
Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon, it's used for everybody. It's used for everybody in the sense that if you have more first graders applying, then you have room for first graders, then all the first graders go in.
Okay.
Or if you have more fifth graders or particular to a grade. I will say the caveat in current law is if a student's already in the school, they're in the school the next year, and the next year they don't have to go through the application and the lottery again.
And siblings.
Yes, a charter school can also give preference to siblings. I don't know any that don't,
right.
Because that's better for the kids and the families. So those are the two kind of, those kids are waived. If you're already in, you're in, you stay in. If your siblings come up, they can come in as well. Other than that, if the number of applicants exceeds space for a grade or a building, there's a lottery.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Next. And we have four other people to speak and
yes.
Two others. So if you could meet.
Well,
I can
wait
brief.
Until the rest of the folks. I'll speak.
Well, we also have two other panels.
Oh, okay. Well, let me just say.
So go ahead.
Quickly.
We need to be brief. We're going a little.
I will try to be very brief. I've had a real struggle with this bill.
We've talked
quite a bit. A few people are going to be smiling a little bit, but don't smile too quickly.
Right.
At this point, I'm planning on supporting it, but I have real problems with it, and it's a basic problem. I think that any time you are able to pick and choose kids, you're basically subsidizing a private school. And so I have a real concern about that. And that's where I am on that. That's one basic issue that I have a concern about. I got a chance to look at the LC opinion. It was halfway through was really a concern, and then it was clear that they had talked about and gotten a chance to look at the at other issues within it. I am very concerned about the implementation. We can write as much as we want, but if the school then says that it's going to implement it primarily based on race, that can be challenged.
Yes, again.
And that can be legally challenged, and I have seen that challenged. And if at some point it is determined that race is going to be something that's going to be used in one school, it can be used in another school in a different community. And I've seen the results of that. Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Virginia come to mind when they started doing this kind of thing. So I am very concerned about it. I will be reluctant, let's put it that way, yes, on this, because I'm not sure how we're going to see implementation and what could happen as a result of it.
Just one response. We have had some really good conversations about this. I believe this is in your, Kairos is in your district.
Yes.
And so I felt even more comfortable when I realized he would be there watching. So that's good for me. I think that having people look and how people do things is really important in any of our systems, and we are public schools, so I appreciate your thoughtfulness on this.
Well, let me just say, I'm not worried about Kairos so much.
I know.
Kairos, I have a pretty good idea. They want to deal with a multicultural school. There's a multicultural school just down the block, just down the street from Kairos as well.
Yep.
It's a public school as well,
right.
And it's a neighborhood school. So you've got two multicultural programs. What concerns me is that some of this language could conceivably be used in other places that would be very discriminatory. And let's just say we have a community that is a low-income white community that says we really want to have a low-income white school.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
That's a real concern of mine.
Yep.
Okay, anything else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Callie Ladd and Eric Knox, and then we'll hear from Shelley Robbins and Paul Berg after they're done. Okay, thank you. Welcome. And make sure you identify yourself for the record before you start.
Okay. Well, hello.
Hi.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Kali Thorne-Ladd, and I am co-founder and executive director of Kairos PDX. Kairos, overall, is a nonprofit committed to ending achievement and opportunity gaps for children of color and low-income youth. Can you hear me?
Yes. Oh, yeah, just push it.
Actually,
you can.
Okay.
They're very sensitive.
Kairos Learning Academy, our flagship program, is a K-5 charter school currently serving kindergarten and first graders. As Karen mentioned, our population is 73% children of color, the majority of whom are African American, and 65% of our students qualify for free and reduced price lunch. I could spend considerable time sharing data about the achievement gap and what's happening here in Oregon. You're aware, I'm sure, that we have one of the 10 worst achievement gaps in the country, and we are ranked, our graduation rates are ranked 49th out of 50 states, and African American and Latino students are ranked below that average. So there's a lot of work to be done, and we all are here and agree upon that. I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about Kairos and our students. And I wanted to share with you a project that we did here. This is the culmination of our identity work, and it was born out of transformation and dramatic play activity. In dramatic play, children pretend to be doctors and singers and engineers, and they dress up and they transform into these different things. When we introduce characters into dramatic play, the teacher observed the dynamics changing. They found that the white or lighter-skinned kids told the black and brown kids that they couldn't be certain characters. And their teacher listened intently to this dialogue that the children were having, and it precipitated longer conversations about the skin that they were in. Children, when they did an exercise around race and the children were asked to draw themselves, the black and brown children were reluctant to draw themselves as black. Most of them drew themselves as white. They said they were white, especially the girls. And one child even said that she did not want to be black because black was bad. and black was ugly. These children are 5 years old. Culturally responsive programs like Kairos counteract the internalization of negative images and messaging that children experience at a young age. For children, these messages accumulate as shame, so much so that they want to disassociate themselves from who they are. Behavioral researcher Brené Brown tells us that shame corrodes the very part of us that believes change is possible. Environments like Kairos become restorative to these children. Brené's research bears out that children store shame as trauma. And this is one of many traumas that many of our children endure. But traumas like these are correlated with negative and maladaptive behaviors, and there's a lot of research that has gone into that. Neuroscientists have also found that the impact of trauma of any kind on the brain is staggering, causing the brain to develop different neural pathways and impacting the development of healthy brain architecture. In short, trauma stunts brain growth. So the good news is that in early childhood, the brain is very plastic, and this brain plasticity gives children the capacity to change as a result of input from the environments that they're in. Children of color and low-income children are exposed to higher doses of stress and trauma, making environments like Kairos critical to their growth, development, and healing. This is not just a nice to have, in my opinion. Science and behavioral research tells us that it's essential. And so your support for Senate Bill 820 doesn't only allow children equitable access to schools. As I see it, it allows them access to the lifelines that can restore and heal them from trauma, shame, and toxic stress. Those things that can have a lifelong impact on their health and well-being. And here, in the pictures that I began with, you can see that these children are holding up self-portraits. And they did an exercise where they mixed paints to match their skin color. And it was an amazing exercise because no matter what skin color you are, you're a mixture of different colors. Mm-hmm. And they were able to see that they were all a mix of different colors. And they matched the skin, the paint, to match their complexion. And they wrote poems that highlighted who they are with pride. And so I wanted to be able to share this with you to say that the environment matters and that having children have access to these environments matter, not only for their well-being and health, but to their brain development. And so with that, I urge you to vote in support of Senate Bill 820. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, sir.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Eric Knox, and I'm a board member here at Kairos. And I run an organization called HOLLA, spelled H-O-L-L-A. And it is a culturally responsive mentoring agency for black and brown kids. And that's what brought me on the board of Kairos. And I do take this pretty personal in terms of being culturally responsive for black and brown kids. And this was what brings me to this whole Senate Bill 820, why I support it. I came here on a basketball scholarship. I ended up at Oregon State in 1985. And to be honest with you, I never really took my academics that serious. I was a black kid that grew up in South Central LA. And I was stuffed into a EOP building at Oregon State University. And again, not that focused academic. I was there to play basketball. That was my major. Academics was my minor. And I learned how to milk the system, to be brutally honest with you. There's ways you can just milk the system as a basketball player that's on scholarship at a university. And I did such. And I remember the Black Student Union decided that they wanted more black teachers and classes and curriculum. And so they decided to pilot a black African-American studies course. And I took it with a lot of other students. But I remember the first paper I had to do, I had to literally, it was about a 15-page paper. And I'd never written a 15-page paper on my own in my entire life. And so I went in the library and grabbed a bunch of books, and I lifted quotes after quotes and put it in the paper thinking that I wouldn't get caught. And after I handed it in about 2 weeks later, the teacher said she wanted to see me in her office, and I went into her office, and I saw the book sitting on her desk of where I literally lifted these quotes from to write this paper. And And she could see me that I was sweating and nervous, and she goes, I know what you did, and you know you could get kicked out, and this is plagiarism, and this is wrong. And he says, we could do one of two things. Either I can just kick you out, or you can write another paper. And she pulled from up under her desk a book called 12 Years a Slave. She slid it over to me, and she says, I want you to read this book, and I want you to write a 10-page paper, single space, on this man, Solomon Northrop. And at the time, it was the middle of the season, and we were getting ready to jump on a flight to Northern California to play Stanford and Cal. And I was, you know, I was like, how am I going to do this? I said, literally said to her, the audacity of me saying, how in the world am I going to do this in 5 days? And she says, I don't know how you're going to get it done, but it was on a Monday. She says, I need it back next Monday. And so I took that book with much trepidation, and I often tell kids that that was the beginning of Eric Knox, the lifelong learner, because once I jumped on a bus on my way to Portland, I was transfixed with the book. I didn't know education was that powerful. I read and read. I went to the games and I read at halftime and before the game and after the game. And when I got to the hotel and I wrote and wrote and wrote, and that paper came, which, you know, the assignment was supposed to be 10 pages, turned into a 17-page paper. And one of the things she said is not only are you going to write this paper, but we're going to have a dialogue about Solomon Northrop. And so when I got back, she did pedagogy with me. Mm-hmm. I was fascinated because it was about my history. And the kind of education that I got growing up as a kid never really gave me much information about who I was as an African-American male here in America. And for the first time reading this book, everything began to make sense to me. My place in the world, why academics were important, why history was important. And so she and I took on this relationship. When I got back, I handed this proudly 17-page paper to her. And the punctuation, editing, all the I'm sure it wasn't that great, but I was fired up. I was motivated. And we took on this relationship in that office where we switched hats, where she was a student, I was the teacher, and other times she was the student and I was the teacher. I mean, that was the relationship we had. The power of that experience, I tell young people and I tell people today, it transformed me as a reader and as a student. I'm now working on my doctorate. Had you told me that when I was a young black boy growing up in South Central in poverty, I would have laughed at you. I wouldn't even know what a doctorate was. But it was this young white woman teaching an African American studies course doing pedagogy with a young black kid from the inner city who was an athlete that had no value in education, gave him a book that connected to his world, that changed his life. And this is why this weighted lottery is important, because of the cultural responsiveness of it that provides opportunity for kids that oftentimes look into books and don't see people or hear history that is about themselves. And so that's what drives me and the school for that kind of opportunity for our kids.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much for your story. That's what we call teaching. We're teaching to the kids. Thank you very much. Okay, we have Shelley Robbins and Paul Berg. We former teachers love it when kids get all excited about a book. So anyway, thank you very much.
Representative Doherty, members of the committee.
And you don't have to be real close to the microphone. You can be 12, 15 inches away.
Yeah. I'm Shel Robbins, and I'm the executive director of Four Rivers Community School in Ontario, Oregon. And we were established in 2003, shortly after the charter law was written. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today. 100% on track for graduation, 100% have applied for college or university, and 85% have earned 12 to 24 college credits by eighth grade. This is the first graduating eighth grade class from Four Rivers Community School, now graduating from high schools in Mount Hare County. Four Rivers Community School is a K-8 dual language immersion school with 255 students. 75% of our students are Latino, 76% are free and reduced lunch, and 11% of our students qualify for special education. We're so proud of their accomplishments and success of our program. Four Rivers Community School is making a difference in Malheur County, which, as you know, is the poorest county in all of Oregon. Four Rivers Community School is here to ask for your support of Senate Bill 820. As a dual language immersion school, it's imperative that we continue to serve the students that benefit most from these innovative models. As you might know, dual language immersion schools were specifically designed for students of that partner language. Dr. Catherine Lindholm Leary and other scholars have conducted large-scale longitudinal studies demonstrating the significant impact that dual language programs have for all students, but cites that the program provides the greatest benefit to English language learners. One of the basic four components of a dual language school is to have half of your students speaking a partner language, in our case that's Spanish, and 50% speaking native English. This provides essential peer models in each language. Classes are taught in each language for 1 week at a time, and that's how we're getting to that proficiency at eighth grade, where students are testing out of Spanish 101, 102, 103, 201, 202, 203 by eighth grade. To achieve this important component, traditional public schools in Oregon have two lotteries, one lottery for native English speakers and one lottery for other languages. Since the school's opening in 2003, I've asked for a waiver to the one lottery charter three times. Although the State Board of Education understands the importance and need for a weighted lottery, they've been unable to make an exception due to the way the law is written. In the kindergarten class of 2013, Four Rivers only had 5 Spanish speakers out of 26. And this is a testament to what happens when, for example, for Kairos, right now it's working because they're a brand new school. But over time, as the school becomes more and more successful and it gets more media attention, the people who are able to access those schools come running. And so then your lotteries are misweighted, so to speak. Dual language programs are only effective with language minority and majority models. A weighted lottery would limit the risk of having English language dominant classrooms and provide much needed access to underserved families. Today, I'd like to ask for your support for the bill and help Four Rivers Community School and other schools like ours continue to be a promising model for our state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today regarding SB 820. My name is Paul Berg, and I'm the principal of the Portland Village School, located in North Portland. We're one of 9 charter schools chartered by PPS, and our mission is to bring the core tenets of Waldorf education to a public school and make it freely available to all students. PVS started in 2007 with 155 students, and now in our eighth year, we have an enrollment of 425 and are a dual-track school serving students in grades kindergarten through eighth. We're proud of our accomplishments over the past 8 years, most notably with the performance of our students in core subject areas, as well as the visual and performing arts. Our board and entire school community are committed to increasing our school's diversity and promoting greater equity. Currently, students of color represent less than 20% of our total population, whereas in PPS overall, they make up over 40% of the student body. PVS would like to have its student body more closely mirror that of PPS schools generally. And despite our annual outreach efforts to Head Start programs and preschools, it's been challenging to diversify our lottery applicant pool. At present, we conduct an annual lottery to admit new students, and in the absence of any waiting, the trend over the first 8 years of the school has been very consistent as far as the proportion of historically underserved groups is concerned. The passage of SB 820 would allow PVS and other charter schools to give additional weight to historically underserved groups and thereby eventually increase diversity and promote greater equity. On behalf of the PVS Board of Directors and our entire school community, I ask committee members to vote in support of SB 820 to allow charter schools to give priority in their lotteries to historically underserved groups and thereby increase both diversity and equity. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of this panel? Okay, thank you all very much. Okay, that's all that we had signed up for to speak on Senate Bill 820. Is there anybody else that would like to speak on this issue? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 820A and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 709A. Richard, if you could read it, please.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 709A modifies provisions to allow students who are not residents of a school district to attend school in a school district, modifies criteria for district school board that the district school board may consider when deciding whether to admit a non-resident student. It modifies criteria the district school board may use to prioritize students. The number of students seeking admission exceeds imposed limitations. It allows priority to students who attend public charter school in district for at least 3 consecutive years. It allows the district school board to revoke consent for non-resident students for failure to comply with minimum standards of behavior and attendance. It does a number of other things, and it declares an emergency effective on passage, and I'm sure the sponsors will do a better job. There's one amendment that the committee has been asked to consider. It is the Dash A3 amendments. They alter the language in the bill to allow districts to offer the same preferences for outgoing students as are offered for incoming students in case of an inter-district transfer.
Okay. Thank you. Who do we have signed up for this one? Okay, Morgan, Allen, OSBA.
May I say something briefly?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before Morgan kicks off his testimony here, it is great when we sit in an education committee and we have a bunch of students in here. And I want to point out Reagan over here in the corner that's with Grandma hanging out today, and Representative McEwen has some constituents here from Siusla High School.
Very good.
In the room, just hanging out at the Capitol for a day, and I love
just
seeing
hanging
that.
Out. Just hanging out. Sounds good. Welcome. Okay.
Thank
Welcome
you,
to
Madam
you,
Chair.
Too.
For the record, my name is Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association in support of Senate Bill 709, the A and Gross version. And as your committee administrator mentioned, we have an amendment we'd like to add to the bill on this side. I think I've talked to all of you or your staff about this because this issue can often be complicated and confusing. But this bill is an attempt to make some improvements to the current inter-district transfer statute so that students and school districts have more options to facilitate transfers and provide continuity to students. And as I mentioned, it passed the Senate 28-0. I've provided on OLIS, and I think I've given you all in advance kind of a one-pager that has the bullets of the changes within the bill. I'll just highlight a couple of them for the record and would be happy to answer questions. I think a couple things that we've discovered, as you know, the legislature has made changes to inter-district transfers, added open enrollment. We now have many different processes that allow students to go between school districts. And as we've engaged those new processes or made changes to old processes, obviously things come up, and all of the things on this list have come from our school districts, superintendents, school secretaries, who've had to deal with parents who get in tough situations. And a couple important ones in the bill that I would mention is, number one, when we changed the inter-district transfer statute, we made a provision that allowed students to who moved during the middle of the school year for whatever reason, they could finish out the school year. Well, what we subsequently discovered is that we have kids who move over the summer and may have missed that transfer window. And this would, you know, the example I always give is, let's say you're heading into your senior year of high school and it's August and something happens in your family has to move, or there's some reason something's come up, and you've missed the transfer window. You're going to miss your senior year in your school district because transfers are done for the year. This would allow those students to have a reprieve and go to school for that next year, just like kids who move during the middle of the school year. The other issue, and this has been a longstanding issue that has always been part of the statute, but when you get, let's say I live in Albany and I get a transfer to Corvallis and I subsequently move to Lebanon, under the interdistrict transfer statute, I need to get a new transfer between Corvallis and Lebanon now. And so my transfer gets voided when I move. And what we have in this bill is a provision that says once a district has accepted you on an interdistrict transfer, if your family subsequently moves, you don't need to get a new transfer to finish out that transfer. There's a couple other things. I know you talked a lot about lotteries and preferences in the previous bill. In the interdistrict statute, there was allowed for sibling preferences, and we've added two new preferences in this bill. The first is those kids who do move over the summer or do move in the middle of school year. If you go to a lottery system for your transfers, you can give those kids priority in your lotteries. And then in the Senate, Senator Thatcher and Senator Gelser added some language to deal with a specific situation for students who attend charter schools for a long term and then age out of those charter schools. You could give preference to those kids in a lottery. Specifically, the example that was trying to be addressed on the Senate side was Sherwood has a K-8 charter school. And so there are students who attend that charter school from neighboring districts who would like to be able to go to Sherwood High School. And Sherwood came, the Sherwood folks and the parents came and basically said, we can't, if we open up slots, we have no way to give preference to these kids who've been in our school district. So it essentially allows long-term charter students to get preference. Again, these are all at the district's discretion. Nothing's mandatory. We're not saying you have to let certain kids in, but it does allow districts to make those choices. And then the Dash 3 amendment would allow those choices both for incoming and outgoing. So if you have siblings that are trying to leave who have had a sibling previously transferred, you could give them the same types of preferences, the same for mid-year moves and charter school students. So I think this bill is really some common sense answers to some of the confusing issues that have come up around interdistrict transfer specifically. We urge your support. We think it'll make the system work better for students and family, provide continuity, and make it easier for districts to implement. And I would say that if you don't pass this bill, that starting this summer, there are going to be kids whose families move over the summer and during the school year who are going to lose their transfers and may not be able to get back in. So we need to take some action right now because we know those problems exist, and we need to make sure those kids have continuity. I know you're probably going to hear some concerns about the bill, and I'd be happy to address those as well. But we urge your support. Again, it passed the Senate unanimously. This is a product of COSA work groups. This is coming to you from COSA and OSBA. Again, it's really about making the system work for families and students and giving districts the tools they need to implement it, I think, the way the legislature envisioned it. So,
yeah, thank you. Any questions of Mr. Allen? Susan, Representative McLean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure. You indicated that you have the support of the superintendents and the principals groups, and that you really have had sort of a work session to try and work out problems. I mean, a lot of people always say, you're making a change, you're making a law, mm-hmm. what's the problem? Mm-hmm. But you've described the problem, and that is that this has been an administrative nightmare in some ways, and that there was a need for more criteria. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that statement? Or?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think, and just a couple other things, you know, some of the things that have come, this doesn't impact charter schools. This doesn't impact open enrollment. This is just about inter-district transfers. And I think one of the things that, you know, this is really based on feedback from school districts and superintendents. And, you know, I've talked to people who work in school districts who have had to have these tough conversations with parents and say, well, we're sorry. You moved over, you know, you moved outside the transfer window, or there's some deadlines that you missed, and you're out of luck until next year. And I think we would all agree that continuity for these kids is probably more important than some of the bureaucratic issues that have come up.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Morgan, as I look at this amendment, if you said earlier, I missed it, and I apologize for that. So this amendment is on this side, not from the Senate side. Was this just not part of the conversation over there? Did you see a piece that was missed? Why do we have the amendment here?
Good question. There? Thank you, Representative Springer. Something that I noticed when we got over to this side, this really came up when Representative Thatcher and Senator Gelser brought forward the issue with Sherwood. So the idea is that Sherwood would like to be able to open up slots and give preference to those kids that attended their charter school. But as you know, this is interdistrict transfers. And unlike open enrollment, on interdistrict transfers, both districts are letting the kids come and go. And so essentially what the amendment does, it allows, if you're limiting the number of students who leave and you're doing lotteries for leaving, which some districts do, just like they do for incoming, it would allow you to give those same preferences. So you could say, we want those charter kids to have a preference out. And it gives, so Sherwood now has the tools to try to get those kids in. And the districts where those kids live now have the tools to help them get to Sherwood. And I think I don't think Senator Gelsford of Miami is saying this. You know what she said? Again, it's a local control issue. This is up to the districts. They have the tools, and they can choose to use them or not use them. But they now have the tools to solve the situation in Senator Thatcher's district.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for doing that. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, very much. And you're available for questions later on?
Absolutely.
Okay, next thing we, Ms. Christie, have signed up, Mark Thielman. Welcome.
All right. Thanks, Rep. Doherty. Members of the committee, I'm Mark Thielman, superintendent in the Alsea School District. I'm also on the COSA committee that kind of did some of this work. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to bring in, there are other camps naturally, and one of my favorite things is if I think something is going to create even more, as you said, administrative nightmares, I like to come and just tell everybody. That way, if it gets passed, I can feel better. So with that, there's a couple of things that this bill does. First of all, I would have liked to have said this to the Senate, on the Senate side, when this bill was over there. But this bill, in its current form, never got a public hearing. And this bill is very much different than what was originally discussed. And most of these changes were introduced in a work session before the Senate committee. So I just chose to wait till it came over to the House. The issue is that this bill also, it has two issues that I think are problematic, and I kind of litmused this while playing golf at a superintendent's retreat. It's always a good time to, and the confusion began in the conversation with four superintendents. Because one said, no, I don't want to have any changes to interdistrict transfer, and I don't want to do a window like open enrollment, which is what this bill allows districts to choose to do. And I said, okay, you're going to be District A. You can be District B because District B said, I don't want to open at all because I'm concerned about liabilities and I don't control things and I want to have no interdistrict transfers. This bill allows for that. District C says, well, I want to do a window, but I want that window to close in June May so I can plan for my budget. This bill will create all of those contingencies. So the whole purpose of it, as it's reported, is that it's designed to fix some things and make things simpler. But the reality of it is it's going to create even more inconsistency, more divisions, more scenarios to have to interpret. It's one of those things where you try to tighten up and it creates more split hairs. So the question I would have is let's just roll this out to its logical conclusion. To me, it's not simpler, nor is it equitable, nor is it consistent. So I'm an open enrollment district, which has a window by statute, but we also allow for interdistrict transfers, and we allow those all year depending on need. I mean, unless I get one like tomorrow, because there's 3 weeks left in a school year, I might say wait till the fall. But my neighboring district could say, well, you know, Mark's had too many of those transfers, and so we're going to set up a window, and then we're going to allow no more. And that student might say, I really want to go to Alsea. And Alsea said they'll take me because they are open interdistrict transfer all year as allowed by statute. But District B says, nope, we're closed. So then they have to go to, as this bill sets up, an ODE hardship criterion list. Yet another step, yet another layer for parents. Now, those parents are going to call me and they're going to say, Mark, how come your rules are different than their rules? And I'm going to say, well, they're District B or they're District C and I'm District A. So I think it's important that at least be on public record that this perspective come and be presented to you, because I'm concerned that it hasn't. The other thing is it also has a prohibition on advertising. And I really don't understand that, because when this originally got started, it was called the Open Enrollment Committee. It's a COSA committee. And this original intent was to create one transfer system that kind of blended a bunch of them together, because we have multiple, to make this simpler. And so some of this language got kind of woven in. I don't know if there's a problem with districts advertising for interdistrict transfer, especially when you have to have permission from both districts to release. The problem is I've gotten a series of emails from charter school people, because I'm partnered with Kings Valley and I do some busing work with them, and we're open enrollment and they're charter and charters are open enrollment. So we have a kindred spirit, a lot of professional back and forth. And their concern, based on their legal people, is that now charter schools won't be able to advertise because they use, a lot of them use state school fund money to do their brochures and to put up billboards and to say, hey, we're getting ready to do our lottery, so on and so forth. So I think it's really important when we really look at this. The third one is we haven't really done a thorough vetting of this particular bill as it's particularly written. There hasn't been a big kind of COSA workshop. There's been some reports and a few emails. And it was that golfing experience that caused me to say, I'm going to go ahead and take the hit, and I'm going to go talk to the Ed Committee on the House side. Are there any questions?
Okay, do you have any questions for this?
Sorry. It's all right. Yeah.
I have a feeling.
One. Hey, Representative Springer.
Got it. Thank you. I apologize, Madam Chair.
Oh, was that your computer?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was fire
at the bell.
I'm not interrupting him, I, Representative. I'll certainly defer. thank you, Madam Chair. So as I look at the bill, and I know you've done a lot of work on this in the past, Mark. Thanks for coming up here. As I look at the bill, in particular the pieces about advertising, mm-hmm. are, unless I misunderstand something here, those are directed at advertising outside of the district boundaries.
It seems to reference recruitment, but that's not what interdistrict transfers have ever been designed to be. It was originally, the whole concept came up because as a response to open enrollment, because certain districts were advertising, mainly mine.
Follow up, Madam Chair. So to be clear then, and certainly staff, you may want to weigh in on this. This isn't going to impede districts currently from doing anything that they do within the boundaries of their school district, just to talk about what they're doing, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, as I read the bill, that's accurate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No, and it doesn't say it does, other than, but charter schools can. You see the number of layers it creates in the mind of the community and the public.
Because we do have public school districts that advertise outside of their boundaries for students to come in and go to their school and
well,
pay tuition.
On a tuition, but that's a completely different system, and that's unaffected by this ban.
Yeah.
But they can. If it's tuition, you can, I guess. You see what I'm getting at? It's a series of things. There is a simpler way to do this. Other states have done it, is that residency follows enrollment, and parents have choices.
Yeah, well,
just FYI.
Well, we used to have that.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Morgan, did you have a question? Because the way I read it, it's advertising located out of the boundaries of the school district is different. Yeah. As opposed to right in the school district.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. I mean, I if there's a district out there that was making a killing on that, I'd like to know. I'd like to call them.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, again, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association, and I think I can answer Mr. Thielman's questions. There's also Cindy Hunt and Emily Nazaroff from the Oregon Department of Education, who are the attorneys that I've vetted this language with, and they can come up and verify this as well if necessary. But on the issue of advertising, what the bill says is you cannot pay for things like direct mailers or billboards or radio commercials outside of your boundaries with state school fund dollars, with taxpayer money. Oregon has a pretty wide open free speech provision in our Constitution. So, for example, if you wanted to buy a billboard in Albany to advertise a school in Lebanon, you could do that with parent money, or if you had a donor do that, or you know, booster club money, you could do that. We can't prevent that. All this says is that you can't spend state school fund money, which includes state general fund dollars and your local property tax revenues on advertising. It's the same as the ban that the legislature approved for advertising for open enrollment. It does not impact charter schools. We worked very specifically with Mary Kramer to make sure that the language does not ban any practices that charter schools currently do, and I vetted that with the Department of Ed, so this has no impact on the operations or advertising practices or recruitment practices of charter schools that I'm aware of, and hopefully if that is incorrect, our friends from ODE will come up and tell me that. And then The other issue that was raised is about windows and timelines. And I think this, Mr. Thielman is right, this is one of the confusing things about interdistrict transfers, but this is not a change from the current statute. School districts have many options. And most of them do it two ways. They either have a window where they accept transfers, so they'll say, you know, from between May 1st and July 1st, we're going to accept applications for transfers for the next school year and be done with it and open up slots. Or they do it on a rolling basis. They'll say, you know, we're unlimited, so anybody, anytime wants to come in or leave, we'll let them go. Or we're going to open up 100 slots, and we're going to do admission on a rolling basis, first come, first serve. So I don't think that's a change from the current statute.
Does this bill just deal with interdistrict transfers?
It does, correct, yeah.
That's
it does not impact open enrollment or charter schools.
Or they're not open at all.
Yeah, but it doesn't affect open enrollment or the tuition-based. It's just...
No.
Inter-district transfers.
Right, and that's why it gets confusing, and understandably so.
But in the inter-district transfer system, comparing current policy to this, it adds yet another series of contingencies and pieces of confusion. So what I'm saying is that if the real intention is to streamline and make things simpler and easier to understand, so that the administrative nightmare can ease... I'm not 100% sure this has been adequately vetted, and I don't see what the harm would be on giving it some time. I do believe we have a short session coming, and based on email correspondence, it sounds like we're going to be back doing this again anyway. So that would be my recommendation to the committee.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you talk about the... raising more difficulty. My understanding is that this actually is an opportunity for ODE to take a look at the hardship piece and actually have more leeway than what districts currently have. And so that's actually supposed to be designed to actually help folks to have more opportunity that they may not actually have now, is my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Can I answer?
Sure.
Or respond you want, Morgan? I thought you were talking to me.
Either. To me, it's more of a statement in my interpretation of the language that I read.
Yeah, and, you know, it does, it says, it gives ODE the authority to say this is what constitutes a hardship, something like the OSAE does or some other organization. But some districts, they don't have a hardship. They say, if you need to leave, we trust you, parent choice. Or if you need to come in, we'll accept you. And so the hardship piece gets applied, especially when there's a closed window and a district. So in my district, a hardship really wouldn't apply because you can go in or you can go out. But in a district with a closed window, then that particular student has to deal with the hardship and the gaming of that, because there's usually some kind of committee process and some appeals process. And so what I'm saying is it puts a whole bunch of layers. So District A, that is fairly open and doesn't have the hardship rules applied because there is no window, they're under a different rule set, and it creates inconsistency. It's not equitable.
I think we need some clarification, because I'm getting mixed. I think I don't know if you're mixing things up, but my understanding of inter-district transfer is that it requires permission from the sending district and the receiving district.
That hasn't
exactly.
changed.
That's it.
And so, that hasn't changed. Changing that.
So this is actually proof of my point.
Yeah. But no, it,
so
but that
if
hasn't
the district
changed.
Says yeah, we accept inter-district that. Transfers all year, we have no window. Okay.
Yeah.
Then there's no issue of hardship. But if District B says we have a window and it's now closed, so if you want to leave or if you want to come in, there has to be a hardship process accessed. And so that creates confusion among families between districts.
Well, no.
And I think
to me, it's just one of the two districts hasn't said yes, right. So it's no longer that's open enrollment is no longer in a district transfer.
Well, yeah, and Rep. Doherty, what's going to happen is parents will call me and say, why do I have to do this for this district and not for this one? And that's what parents will do. That's what will be said.
Because that one's not an open enrollment.
Chair Doherty and Representative Fack, I think what I would say is that your characterization is correct.
Thank you.
the essentially, and I'm looking right now at the Department of Education FAQ on interdistrict transfers, and I'll just paraphrase from it. It says, basically, hardships can be given in the event of emergency to protect the health, safety, or welfare of the students. Examples of an emergency would include sexual assault, threats against a student's life, or threats of imminent harm. And that's a pretty high bar. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've discovered as people have had situations arise in districts. And so we had conversations with the Department of Education as the bill was drafted, and I think they feel comfortable working to sort of give a definition to what a hardship is. Mr. Thielman is right that the hardship, again, is at the discretion of the school district, but that's not a change. That's current statute. That's current law. So we see that as a broadening for districts who have situations that don't meet what I would argue is a very high bar when circumstances arise in children's lives to deal with it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think it's good.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Quickly, please.
Yeah, this is not a question. I want to, because I made that statement, okay?
I wrote it down.
I know. And you've said it twice. Yeah. And so I just want to make it clear. What I'm trying to talk about is it was with with the inter-district transfers. But what I really appreciate from what you said, sir, was that basically that when we overlay things like open enrollment and in-district transfers and everything else, we have to look at it as an integrated system.
Exactly.
And I really appreciate the comments that you made, and I really will go back, and I promise to look at the inter-district transfers and the open enrollment and see if I can see what some of those issues are that you've mentioned.
I appreciate it.
So,
thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. That's all that we had signed up for. Senate Bill 709A. Anybody else? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 709A and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 216A. Richard, if you could read the summary, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 216A adds Education Service Districts, ESDs, and state tribes to the list of entities that shall receive funding from the Oregon Department of Education for the specified purposes of the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning. It modifies those purposes for which funding is distributed. It requires the OEIB, the Oregon Education Investment Board, to provide strategic direction to the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning, the NQTL, by convening an advisory group. It requires application of school district to participate in beginning teacher and administrator mentorship program, and requires that the application include a description of priorities to be addressed by monies received by the school district for the mentorship program, and requires that the mentorship program include at least 75 to 90 hours of frequent contact between members and beginning teachers and administrators throughout the school year. It declares an emergency effective on passage. The committee has been asked to consider the A2 amendments, which allow an additional allocation of up to $50,000 if a school is less than 1,500 weighted average daily membership, ADMW, and it defines the acceptable uses for that additional allocation.
Okay. Okay, with that, we have two people signed up, Ozzie Rose and Julie Smith, Cindy Hunt, and Hilda Rosselli. You want those?
Yeah. Okay.
And we also have Ozzie Rose and Julie Smith. Whoever would fit in the most.
I can fit.
Hey, thank you very much.
Chair Daugherty, Vice Chairs Frederick and Springer, for the record, my name is Hilda Rosselli, and I serve as the Director for College and Career Readiness at the Oregon Education Investment Board, and as a result of my responsibilities, I have had the pleasure of working with many of the projects related to the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. Senate Bill 216-A2 makes modifications to statutes that govern this Network for Quality Teaching and Learning that includes the eligibility to receive funding and to administer programs for the regional ESDs and our Oregon tribes. It provides clarity around the role of the OEIB and the ODE and formalizes an advisory group. We have had one that has been meeting informally. This just makes that a little more formal. It allows ODE to contract with nonprofits to administer a nonprofit to administer the school district collaboration fund. It provides an allowance for districts participating in collaboration grants to explore additional innovative practices beyond the four primary components in the grant. It modifies the language, as was mentioned, around the Oregon Beginning Teacher and Administrator Mentor Program by changing the definition of frequent contact from 90 hours to a range between 75 and 90 hours. Requires more details about the priority addressed by the programs in their district applications. And I would add that those changes to the mentor program have all been discussed through a collaborative process with stakeholders. And although we may not have 100% agreement, there is a general consensus that these concerns around the removal of the 90-hour reference would support strengthening of the mentoring program, but not water it down to a point where it loses its impact. Just as a reminder, the original purpose of this network was to provide a system of the support to our Oregon educators, because we know the value that our teachers have on impacting student learning. After the bill passed the Senate, these A2 amendments were suggested, and I have colleagues on both sides who will explain the nature of those and answer questions regarding that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Cindy Hunt, Government Legal Affairs Manager for the Oregon Department of Education. As Hilda mentioned, the network was a collaboration effort between the Oregon Education Investment Board and the Department of Education. And it's a relatively young network. It's only 2 years old. And it was a fairly major piece of legislation, as any major piece of legislation, as we were working it through and giving out the grants, there were some relatively minor tweaks that needed to be done. And so we worked collaboratively with stakeholders, and the result of that is the bill that's in front of you. So I'm here basically to offer our and testify in support of this legislation, also in support of the amendments that you'll hear a little bit later about. We also work collaboratively on those and to answer any questions that you'd specifically have about the network or the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Hi.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and committee. I am Julie Smith. I am the Educator Effectiveness Coordinator at the Chalkboard Project, and I'm a former elementary school teacher, and I'm pleased to be here in support of Senate Bill 216. I'm here offering kind of clarity on Dash 2 amendments being considered by the committee today. And this has come out of our work in the field with our small districts who are participating in the School District Collaboration Fund. Currently, we have four districts in program who are have enrollment less than 1,500 students. For example, St. Paul has 272 kids, and using the current ADMW formula would actually result in a smaller implementation grant than they have had for their design grant. And so we need to make sure that these smaller districts have the capacity that they need to move forward with all the great work that they've spent a year designing. So what the amendment would do, it would provide a grant up to $50,000 to districts with less than 1,500 students to be used to kind of build that capacity and purchase maybe a half-time teacher to run the grant. And so what these grant managers do is they're the ones that ensure implementation of programs with fidelity. They monitor their effectiveness. They help them adjust these innovations to work best for teachers and for students. And then they also can do the reporting and accountability work that is needed for the grant. And we have seen, I've had the honor of working on a rural kind of research and development project through Chalkboard, and we've really seen out in our small districts that this human capital capacity is an issue. And so what the School District Collaboration Fund does in general is it seeds innovation so that we can move forward for our kids. And so what these districts, these small districts, will be able to do is they'll be able to design some solutions to these capacity needs that are plaguing our little districts and generalize that across the state. So thank you for considering your support of Senate Bill 216, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, are there any questions of the panel? Representative McLean.
And I have to be honest, I haven't done my homework on this one as far as read the amendments, and so I need to do that, and I appreciate the discussion and also the precursor for those. The one item that I have to keep saying out loud, because I think it's part of my, you know, my job, is to say I really appreciate supportive programs that are helping, you know, build capacity or to build programs that are going to assist and support a particular endeavor or mission in a school. But right now, I really have to say that the majority of the schools that I've seen need more aides or more teachers in the classroom to actually be able to work with students, and that interaction between the student and the teacher is so important. And so to have a $50,000 grant that's going to a grant manager means that's $50,000 that, you know, would be in a program that, in my understanding, doesn't necessarily assist with the program actually being implemented. It's, as you point out, it's somebody who's going to do the report. It's somebody that may be the liaison. It may be the person that actually designs part of the program. And if I'm all wrong, just tell me so.
Sure.
I want to understand, you know, why we would put more resources into more of a generalized approach again, mm-hmm. where, you know, you have a program, you have an idea, you have a concept, and you really need to have people who are there to actually implement, not outside of the classroom, but inside of the classroom.
Sure. And a lot of our grant managers are inside of the classrooms. They are the people helping to helping the teachers implement with fidelity. So, for example, when there's new assessment work being done, those grant managers have the time and space to do the professional learning themselves and then go into the classrooms and help the teachers design their assessment work or present it to the PLC so that those professional learning communities, mm-hmm. Which are collaboration groups between teachers, can learn what they need to learn to do their work with fidelity. So where we've seen there hasn't been this capacity, all these great things will happen in design teams, but nobody owns it to go out and implement it. So it lives more in the design document, in the implementation plan, than it does in action.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to compliment you on that. I've actually seen this work happen, and she's exactly right. Without the implementation, the plan is only as good as the plan on the piece of paper. So I completely respect what the representative had to say, but I have actually personally firsthand witnessed that. And without that, nothing happens. It just doesn't get done. And so I commend you for stepping out and doing that, because the plan is just the plan until you actually go out and work it. And the teachers, without having them come alongside and help do that, they're just overwhelmed already. And so to add that one more component to that is just too much. And so the successful ones that are actually making this work and happen are doing that work. And so I commend you for what you're doing. Nice job.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Can I just say I know we're on a time frame.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I want to make it clear, because I'm not in a different place than Representative Hack as far as what she described as a result that I would champion, but I'm just not there yet seeing that happen, because I've been in those communities just recently, and I've been in those study groups, and I've been in those curriculum meetings, and I've been in the point where the teachers are actually working. But again, the person that you're describing, even if they're in the classroom taking notes and trying to bring an assessment to that classroom for that particular project, again, it's just somebody who is coming from the outside in to observe sometimes, or to assist with a final test, or to help say, well, these are the criteria that the test would have to cover to be able to get to an assessment of this project idea. And that's great. I mean, that's fine. But I'm saying that there is a need to actually have boots on the ground and people in the classroom, so we can have smaller classes and we can have aides for people that are on IEPs. The IEPs continue to grow. You know, 11% IEPs used to be sort of like the norm. It's not any longer. There's like up to 20% IEPs in some classrooms in some school districts. And so, you know, it's the difference between just modeling, looking at, and giving a good idea. The implementation comes when you've actually got the teacher or the aide in the classroom to actually express that particular program
you know, responsibility or program concept. And so it's nice to have the middle people, but again, they're more data collectors and they're more assessment managers than they are actually people working with kids. And so I want to go one more step, you know, besides, you know, just getting the good ideas on paper and getting the good ideas off paper and into the classroom. I want actually practitioners there that are going to get to use those ideas and those assessments on a regular basis with smaller classes. So I agree with what she's saying as far as that might be the middle work, but the finished work is actually dealing with the students on an ongoing basis.
Right. And that, to me, is like kind of one step forward, because this bill deals with allowing the ESDs to get the funding to go through and do these programs. But it's the same sort of thing of programs that sits on a shelf. Yeah.
Chair Dougherty and Representative McLean, I would just add one piece. And what I've been very impressed with this project is that, first of all, it has had tremendous impact on student performance. And we often are looking for interventions that actually do have a track record of helping kids succeed in schools. This one is consistently showing that. Secondly, I think what's really commendable, and that it's behind the whole concept of the network, is that in when I was a classroom teacher, professional development was done when, okay, on a certain day of the year, you all go to Salem. And, you know, you go through a workshop, and then you go, wow, that was a great workshop, and then I go back to my classroom and it kind of dies because I'm overwhelmed with everything that is in my daily workload. I think one of the things that this project does is it elevates the role of teachers in actually designing what kinds of professional development help them in their classrooms and really help them think about what they need in order to implement. And so I see this one small piece here as the equity part that we're bringing to the size of districts. We've gotten feedback from the whole network that in cases where it was difficult to generate the level of support across the state, it was generally because there wasn't a person who had a little bit of release time to do that work to carry it forward. So I just thought maybe perhaps that might be helpful in explaining even a little more.
Okay, thank you.
We can take this offline.
Okay, any other comments, questions? Okay, thank you very much. The other person we have signed up, Mr. Rose? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Rose passes. Anybody else on Senate Bill 216A? Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 216A. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 790A. Richard, if you could remind us what it is.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 798 requires the Department of Justice to encourage and support services, programs, and curricula to educate and inform students in grades 7 to 12 about domestic violence.
Okay.
Chair Dougherty, I move the Senate Bill 790A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves Senate Bill 790A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Tia, could you read the roll, please?
Representative Redham?
Aye.
Representative Pat?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Dougherty?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. Do we have anyone that would like to carry this bill on the floor? Going?
Aye.
Going?
I thought somebody brought that to us. I'm looking real quick.
Senator Hansel.
Pardon? It was Senator Hansel.
Oh, yeah. He's not on that House
side,
is he?
No, he's not on our side. He's not on our side. Representative Peluso, thank you very much for carrying that. Okay, with that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 790A and open up a work session on Senate Bill 856.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 856 requires each school district board to adopt child sexual abuse prevention instructional programs for students in kindergarten to grade 12.
Okay.
Chair Dougherty, I move Senate Bill 856 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves Senate Bill 856 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Tia, could you read the roll, please?
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Chair Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. Ken, do we have anyone that would like to carry this? Okay. Between the two of you, would you like to co-carry it? Okay. Okay, Representative Hack will carry the bill. Thank you very much. Okay, that's all we have on the agenda. Anything for the good of the order? Okay. We do. Reminder, we have... Oh, I'm sorry, you guys. We have no meeting on Friday.
Oh, no.
But I can bring you in if you want me to.
Can we just come together?
Is it time to adjourn?
Yeah. And we have no meeting on Monday. I understand the building is closed on Monday, so our next meeting is going to be Wednesday, 5:27.
Oh.
Okay, so with that, I close the House Education Committee.
What will we do? What will we
I don't know. I don't know.
I have no problem answering that.
No.
I don't know. I have no problem answering that.